Mr. George Martin, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Martin?
I was born in Glaston, just to the south of Liverpool, about 7 miles down the river on the north bank. There are three docks there, actually, quite small docks. But I suppose one of the interesting facts is that the elders and wives' line used to bring in their bananas to that dock, and I used to go and watch them unloading, which is very interesting.
What was your date of birth?
Date 13th of April, 1916.
And what did your father do for a living?
Well, my father worked on the docks, varied between unloading timber from many of the little coasters that used to come in, and this was then stacked on acres of land, which they used for storing the timber before it was then dispatched to builders all over the north west of England. In the 30s, that was a very bad time. It was a depression, there was a lot of unemployment. And I remember the days that as a small boy, my father was not working for maybe a week or two at a time. And he was a very fortunate occasion to get casual work. As things picked up in the 30s, then of course his work was regular. He was killed in an accident in the early days of the war, sadly.
How did the unemployment and just the general hardships of the period affect your family life at home?
Well, money was tight. There was a brother besides myself, just the two of us, and although we didn't want for anything, money was tight. We had to be very careful. Mother did a lot of work for herself. She mended clothes and all the rest of it to try and economise as much as possible. We lived reasonably well. We didn't want for anything. But as I say, there was no time for luxury. There was no money for luxury.
What about your education? Which school did you go to?
I went to St. Francis School. It's an elementary school of the period where you started at 5 and finished, as we did in those days, at 14. But I was fortunate in one sense in that my parents decided that, and I loved craft work, that I would go to a junior technical school. This was sort of a 2-year course. It was about 3 miles away, and I went by tram to get to that school.
Was that after you'd finished, at 14 you went
to? No, 13 and a half I left to go there, 13 and a half, and I finished at 15 and a half.
Was that your main interest at school, craft work?
Craft work it was, yes. I sometimes think that my academic work went down the drain a little bit. In my preference for craft work, I loved woodwork in particular. That was my main subject.
What was it you liked about it so much? Why did it catch your
attention? It was creative. I loved wood in the sense that it had grain. There was a feeling about wood. It was a natural material. And even two pieces of oak, they were completely different in grain and texture. And I loved the smell of pine. And each timber had its own characteristics and qualities. And you, with experience, got to know them, what you could do with each particular timber. And I really was thrilled about that. And that's what I enjoyed.
And you did this at home as well. That was your hobby.
That was a hobby as well, yes.
What would you make? I mean, as a lad, I'm talking about when you're a young lad and growing up.
Well, I made little stools and things like that. And neighbours would ask me to do a little job for them. And I used to put a shelf up for one or two people that make the shelves.
So it was practical rather than sort of model making or
Oh yes, I didn't do much model making, it was practical. There was an end to the craft work as far as I was concerned. I'd like to make something that I could see what I'd made. And if it was somebody wanted a little stool, I would make that for them.
Now when you went to the technical college, what sort of techniques and training did they give you there?
Well, as a junior technical school, the emphasis was on technical work. We had woodwork, metalwork, technical drawing, physics and chemistry, English and maths, but they were all biased towards technical subject, building work in particular. And that's, again, something that I enjoyed. And at that stage, I think I made a pledge to myself that I would be a woodwork teacher. Eventually, that's what I wanted. How I was going to achieve it, I wasn't sure because there was no chance of going to the training college in those days. But that was what I was aiming for. I went there for 2 years, and it was an interesting school in that the staff, most of them had been in the First World War. They were practical men, they were keen on discipline, and they took anybody from the school who wished to go on an excursion to the Lake District for a day. Now, in its day, that was quite a feature. There were not many schools went on school trips anyway. And I went on that one, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I've got photographs of the staff and three of my friends who went with me on the trip. One of the friends, a particular pal, we kept in touch until he died in 1993. And we used to go cycling together and all over the place. It was a marvellous life. And he was ever such a pleasant chap. And he had one eye, and yet he cycled, and he was into the army. But then the pioneers, mind you. But he was a grand chap. And he had a grocery shop when he came out of the army. He was in Bolivia.
Now, what about your other hobbies? Photography, I mean, I know that's an interest now, but you mentioned taking photographs then.
Yes.
Was it an interest at the time as well?
It was. I was always interested in photography. We had a little box camera, a Brownie box camera when I was a boy, and this was one of my, favourite objects, which went with me on if I went cycling. That was in the carrier bag on the back. I got one photograph which I show as a slide now, which was taken 70 years ago, of an aircraft taking off from what later became Speke Airport, an old biplane, Imperial Airways biplane, and it was taken with this box camera. I panned it as it took off, and it blowed up on the screen about 8 feet square, and it's really sharp, and I'm very proud of it, taken as a boy.
Did you develop your own? I mean, was it?
I didn't do anything like that. I had them trade processed by a chemist. Now, he was a very pleasant chap, actually, and he was my mentor in a way, because I took my films to him, and they were 24 hours developing time and printing, and he must have been fed up with me, because 24 hours to the dot, I was outside his shop looking at my watch to see if 24 hours was up. And I'd go in, and if there was somebody in the shop, he would say, "I will see you in a few minutes, young man." And that they would go out, and he'd get my film out, and he'd say, "Now, shall we have a look at what you've been up to?" And he'd go through them. "Now, your composition on that one, really, you should try and get the tree a little bit to the left so they're not in the centre." And I took one, I always remember it, of my grandmother. She was sitting on a chair in the backyard at home. And I got a marvellous picture of the brick wall, every line. And I remember saying to him, "I like that one. Just look at the texture of those bricks." He looked at me and he said, "I thought you were photographing your grandmother." "Oh," I said, "I did, but just look at the bricks behind her." He said, "Well, next time you photograph your grandmother, get her away from the wall so that the bricks aren't as sharp as they are there, and turn her sideways. She looks a little bit like a prisoner there, having a photograph taken." I always remember that. And, you know, it stuck with me, that little bit of advice, how to take a portrait and to soften the background. But he was very good. He always would go through them with me, spend a little time, and help me. And that, I think, increased my interest, because I learned how to take photographs in good composition and pleasing arrangements.
Did you have did they cover that at the technical school, photography?
No,
or any other courses?
No,
you would?
No, nothing like that.
What about other hobbies? You mentioned cycling.
Well, cycling, yes. This friend of mine from the junior technical school, he was a great friend. He had a bicycle and I had a helmet. So he taught me how to ride. I could follow his bike, go around the field or something like that. And eventually I mastered the art of driving a bicycle. And when, having done that, I brought my friend home with me and suggested that it might be nice if I got a bicycle too. My father said, "Oh yes, you can ride, can you? I said, oh yes, boss, taught me how to ride. So father said, well, in that case then, Bob will be going round with you on the bicycle. I'll see you get one. So we went off to some second-hand shop that he knew, and I got a very nice bicycle. I don't think it cost more than 10 shillings. And it was in good condition, because I think it was called a Stanley. Never heard of it before. But it served me well for a number of years. And Bob and I used to go riding, and my camera went with me, you see. And this is where my interest in cycling stemmed from. I used to then, when Bob wasn't around, I'd go off on my own. And as I left school and started work, I would go on holidays over to Wales on the Wirral and over to North Wales cycling. And I could even as far as Flanders Mill on the bike from Liverpool. So it stood me in good stead my learning to ride.
Now, what about sport? Were you interested in sport?
Yes, I was. I was interested in cricket. There was a park not very far from where I lived, just at the top of the street, and it was a recreation ground, and I could be seen up there regularly playing cricket with a number of pals in, around in the back. I made my own pads, in fact, with cardboard and tape on them and covered them with the material. My cricket bat and loved playing cricket, and I was determined to be a professional cricketer.
Well, you were good then?
I was quite confident at cricket, yes. I played for the school team on a couple of occasions. But I remember my uncle saying to me, he said, are you going to be when you grow up? He was a boxer, by the way. I had no intention of following him. I said, well, I'm hoping to be a professional cricketer. No, it's no use, that's for you, George. He said, there are too many men with money who play cricket, you'll never make a professional. You're not getting enough money out of that. No, you'll have to find something else to do. I was a bit disappointed with that, but as it turned out, it was true. I did play a bit of cricket, but not to any great standard. And when I started work, I hadn't the time.
Before we come to your work, what about, were you in any of the boys' societies? I'm thinking the boys' brigade, Boy Scouts, anything like that?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't in any of those.
Did it not appeal to you, or...?
I wasn't awfully keen. I did think once of joining the Scouts, but... I seem to have so many other things to do. I would kept making things, and my photography, and I used to draw maps of the local area, trying not actually to scale, but at least they showed all the streets, and I got the proportions right as to where the streets joined one another. And I did one of the whole of my district, actually, which I was quite proud of. Didn't do any good, mind you, but it was interesting as far as I was concerned.
Now, what were you to do when you left school? You'd been at the technical school, would it be in 1929 to 1932, round about then?
I finished in the midsummer of 31.
31, sorry, yeah. And then what were you to do? How did you get a job?
Well, we were offered jobs from the school to some extent. I would love to have gone to a place across the Mersey in the world where they were making aeroplanes. They were known as Popjoy. They were little chubby things, monoplanes. And I would love to have gone there because I was interested in flight. But it was too far to go. We couldn't afford the fares on the tram and then across the ferry. And it would be a long journey back again. And my father didn't think that they'd last very long. I don't think they did, actually. But that fell through. And I went to work as an apprentice joiner in a place in the Liverpool called... HB Greens at Knight Street, and this was quite a big firm in a way. They had their own drawing office. They produced a tremendous amount of work for West Africa, as they were colonies, of course, in those days, and Takoradi and Lagos were the main centres where we sent the finished work. They also sent out form joiners who would supervise the work on site, and we produced windows, shutters, bank counters, all the woodwork for the place. And this was then packed up, and I was given the job of stenciling on Lagos or Takoradi, and it was all in pitch pine because it was the only timber the white ants wouldn't touch. Now, it was interesting there because the smell of deep cutting pitch pine was marvellous. There's a beautiful smell to it, and the timber itself was interesting, but there's such a range of different styles and patterns of grain. I used to love that. And I also had the job of filling the Gladstone bag of the wood workshop foreman with little bits of scrap wood of pitch pine to a given length to make sure you got enough firewood. And that was one of my jobs, apart from making tea. I stayed there, and they were going to give me an indenture for 5 years. But the pay wasn't very much, I think it was only about 7 or 6 months a week. And I think the father thought that wasn't quite enough. And the work was sort of easing off. They were not doing much locally, they were doing all this for overseas, and there were periods when we were around the stuff. So I finished that.
When would that be?
You
started 31.
Yes, after about 6 months, I finished that.
So just into 32, or?
Pardon?
Just into 32, not
that's right, yeah, just into 32. I was unemployed then for a while, and the boy I played with, his father was an electrical contractor. And he said, well, if you've got nothing to do, I think Dad could fix you up with a job for the time being. So I said, all right, what is it? He said, well, it's electrical work. I said, oh, very impressed. He said, well, try it for a while anyway. So I tried it. And luck would have it, the firm were actually converting Belmont Road Workhouse over to electricity from gas. Well, for a boy, I was 16, that was the next period to go into a workhouse. They were taking the heavy cables in, they were wiring the whole place from one end to the other. But you can imagine what a workhouse was like in those days.
It was still occupied then?
Oh yes, it was occupied, yes. Oh yes, and nobody was moved out. They just moved the bed away from the wall if you wanted to get to the wall. And the hospital part of it, oh, it was sad to see it, it really was. I was rather depressed by seeing all the sick and poorly people there who've got no relatives, any of them, nobody to go and see them. And I wasn't happy with electricity, I didn't like the job.
Were you an apprentice or were you just working as a labourer?
I was working there, I was doing a little bit of electrical work, but I wasn't happy at all, I didn't want it as a job. And as the work sort of got to the end, and by the way, we were working in some big houses there as well, which were part of the workhouse scheme, offices and so on, and apparently they'd been ship owners' houses, and there were chains fastened to the walls of the cellar, and the story was that they were the chains where slaves were fastened to when they were taken to the ships. That was the story. How true it was, I don't know, but I decided that it was time I moved from that, so I went from there, and I was going to the technical college do a City and Guild course in carpentry and joinery. And to fill my time in for a short space of time, I worked in a do-it-yourself shop where I sold timber, nails, screws, you name it, I sold it. And I converted the counter to a bench, and I put a vise on it, and I made mantel boards. Now, these were very popular in the early 30s to put on the stone slab mantelpiece with a decorative moulding on over the old-fashioned ranges which were popular in most of the old terraced houses in those days. And I used to do the mantel boards to order, which I quite enjoyed doing. Mitered corners, nailed and polished. And I worked there while I was going to the technical college in the evenings. Now, the woodwork teacher, the carpentry teacher, asked me where I worked. And he said, you're wasting your time there, you know, young man. I said, well, in what sense? I said, I quite enjoy it. I'm making things. He said, would you like to come and work for me and be an improver in my joiner's shop? I said, well, where do you work from? He said, oh, entry. Well, now, that's 12 miles away, right around the other side of Liverpool. Oh, I said, I live at Garston. He said, oh, I've got a bicycle, I'll come if you'll have me. So we agreed on a salary, which wasn't brilliant, but it was far better than anything I was getting. And as I liked cycling, I decided I'd give it a try. Well, now, they were very good firm of builders, and they were building up all over McCall and the far side of Entry round Racecourse. He said, well, if you're coming over that distance, I'm not going to have you going out onto the building site. I'll have you in the workshop, which was at Entry near Hartley's Gambler. I said, well, that suits me. So I went there as an improver, which was a bit better than an apprentice's wage. And I was, he was, seemed to be very satisfied with the quality of work.
Now, what did an improver do?
He was an apprentice, in a sense, but he was given a higher wage because he was more responsible, and he was given extra, more important work to do, because he was considered to be a bit above the apprentice stage. And that this was what I was there to
do. Now, you hadn't actually done your apprenticeship, though, had you?
I had no apprentice, no. But I was working in wood ever since I was at school, you see. And I'd mastered the skills of joints and all that sort of thing, and a fair amount of design.
So, in a sense, you didn't have to do your apprenticeship?
I didn't have to do my apprenticeship, no. But while I was there with him, I was guided by the other craftsmen there. And one of the great features of that workshop was that we made all our own windows, stairs, doors, kitchen fitments, and as well as anything else that anybody wanted as a special order. I graduated onto setting out, and I was shown how to set out, and I was given the job of setting out small items. And eventually, I would, as the years went on, I set out windows and doors and things like that. We had machinists in the workshop, but there again, you were allowed to do a bit of machining, which again was abuse, you see. By the time I finished there at 21, which was the form in those days, you had to finish when you were at 21, so you would get experience in other works. And I was sacked. But it was a worthwhile experience being there. I didn't go out very much. I worked in the shop. I did a few outside jobs. We used to do quite a bit of work for Jacobs, the biscuit people. They had a big factory there. And I used to go on jobs there quite often because that was convenient to the workshop. Winter was a bit of a problem. Riding out there on the winter morning in snow and ice. I remember going there one day having fallen off my bike, ripped my trousers from top to bottom. Fastened it with safety pins, got another pair of trousers when I got home. Just missed a car that slithered past me on an icy surface. It was quite an experience, but it taught me that if the wind was against me, I'd got to go off earlier. If the wind was behind, I could have another 5 minutes at home. But it was good lecturing in a way, in a sense. I got to watch the weather, the times and so on. To get there by 8 o'clock, that was the important thing. But I enjoyed my work there. It was very good indeed. I learned an awful lot, which was very good.
Were you still going to the
site, yes. I took my City and Guilds intermediate, first class pass. I took my City and Guilds final with a first class pass. And I then studied building construction. Because if I go back just to the day when I was at the school, my early days, one of the masters there, a woodwork shop that we used to go to, it wasn't in the school, it was a technical handicraft centre. He was a very nice chap, and he took me under his wing because I confided in him as a little boy that I wanted to be a woodwork teacher. And he said, how are you going to do that now, young man? I said, well, I want to be a craftsman. He said, well, you come to me at the end of this lesson and I'll tell you how to do it. And remember what I tell you. He said, it will be a lot of hard work, but you will achieve it if you persevere. I got to get my City and Guilds, I got to get the National Building Certificate and become a craftsman, and then I would be accepted by the Ministry of Education to teach in a technical college or a junior technical school. Because if you followed up, I made a note of what I got to do. And I followed it religiously right through. I took my City and Guilds, I took my National Building Certificate. And by now, it was getting on in 1937. And of course, as you are well aware, there was trouble in Europe, and it was obvious that things were not going to improve. However, I got my national building certificate, I got my citizen girls, I then studied for higher national, thinking that this would be an added incentive if I wanted to apply for any position. Sadly, classes finished when the war started, so I didn't achieve that. I'd also taken a summer course on architecture because sort of flights of fancy, I thought I might even become an architect in one of these days. Of course, we didn't realise that the war was going to interfere. Now, I didn't go for teaching because, having finished at this Ainsworth workshop, I then went to a big firm at Speke near Liverpool, where the Liverpool Airport is today. This was a very big building for them. They had a massive joiner's shop and a big machine shop of equal size. And they were building all over the area to our northeast. It was a mass production shop in which every bit of woodwork was produced in the shop. And I got the job there of being their chief setter out. And this I quite enjoyed. You were responsible for producing the pattern from which all the other pieces would be made. It was a responsible job, because if they wasted stacks of timber, it didn't last long. So I enjoyed that very much. We had, I suppose, anything up to 20 joiners working in the shop and about 4 in the machine shop, plus all the other trades out in outbuildings who went out onto the building site. And I was there when war broke out.
Now, had you seen war coming at all? I mean, were you aware of Hitler, Germany?
Oh, yes, I was well aware of it. It was in the papers, of course. We lived with no telly, you heard him on the radio. But I think anybody with any common sense saw that war was almost inevitable. Because although Hitler said he was satisfied when he took over one country, the moment he got that, he got his eyes on another one, and he was just moving across Europe.
Now, did you think of joining, I mean, I suspect you were too busy, but did you think of joining the territorials or anything, or did you think it would involve you?
I thought it would involve me eventually, but we were so busy at work, on government work, that for the time being I was quite satisfied with what I was doing.
When you say government work, is that after the outbreak of war or before?
At the beginning, just before.
Now, what were you doing that was government work just before the outbreak of war?
Well, we were doing plotting tables and blackouts because it was obvious that the city of Liverpool would be a main port for convoys. And the various government departments, just before the war and at the beginning of the war, were taking over buildings for use by the naval authorities for convoy work and things like that. Speak was an aerodrome which obviously was being built up for fighter planes, and that they were producing aeroplanes in a factory there. They were Blenheim bombers were being produced, and later Dakotas were being put together. They came in crates from America and they were put together there. We were doing blackouts.
Now hang on, what were these plotting tables though? What exactly were they?
You know, but if you've seen the RAF girls with like a stick with a square end on, pushing planes across, those were the plotting tables.
And you made naval and air ones?
Yes, naval and air ones. We also did hundreds of blackouts.
Now what was a blackout?
The blackout was to cover windows, because they were used all day long and all night long, these premises, and they had to have lights on, but they had to have blackouts so that air could get in the room, but no light outside. And these blackouts had a vent in them so that there was no light spilling out, but there was air going in. We had sheets of papers. They were all planned for us, how to do them, and stacks of sizes. And we produced these, I must be hundreds, just before and at the beginning of the war. We then went on to making the formwork for concrete pillboxes.
Now, that would be when the war started. I'll come back to that. What about the actual declaration of war? I mean, do you remember the day war broke out?
Yes. I was at church, and it was 11 o'clock, service was on, and the priest came out onto the altar and said, I have to declare to you, and I'm sorry it has happened, but war has been declared at 11 o'clock today. All remember that. And that was in, obviously, 1939. And I was courting